When the landscape is blanketed with snow, there are many things that cannot be seen, but some things that are normally hidden become clear. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today to help us unlock some of the secrets of wintertime wilderness. We'll talk about finding the tracks of wild creatures in the snow, where to look for those tracks, and how to identify them once they've been found. Once you know if you're looking at the tracks of a coyote or a schnauzer, we'll talk about how to interpret those tracks and what we can learn from them and what scientists can also learn from them. You're welcome to call us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Please join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll unlock a secret code hidden in the snow. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today to talk about finding animal tracks in the snow. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. I must apologize to our listeners right up front for my gravelly voice. It's that time of year when these things happen.
Well, so. You're gravelly and I'm nasally, so together
we'll make a good pair. Right.
Together we'll get something done here. Well, let's talk about animal tracks. If you want to look for the tracks of wild animals in snow, where do you start looking?
Well, in the snow. The thing about tracking in the winter is that you can see. I mean, it's not that the animals aren't there in the rest of the year, and it's not that you can't find them, but you have to be a much more skilled tracker. Snow makes it easy, and that's the beauty of it. You can be in the city, you can be in the country, you can be in parks, you can be on the roadsides, and there will be animal tracks almost wherever you go. And the beauty of the snow is that you can see them. Leopold said in Sand County Almanac, Aldo Leopold said, January observation can be almost as simple and peaceful as snow and almost as continuous as cold. There is time not only to see who has done what, but to speculate why. I thought it was a beautiful way of talking about a January tracking.
Absolutely. So if you're interested in looking for wild animal tracks, are there places that are better to go?
Oh, certainly. Certainly any place there is wildlife habitat, you'll find tracks. As I say, you can do it in the city, in the country, sometimes in your backyard. There are things I think that people often pass by, not even noticing that little deer mouse track that goes out from underneath their deck to the bird feeder and then back, underneath the bird feeder and back. Or they tend not to notice the deer that wandered through the back of their yards. So certainly the better wildlife habitat you have, the more tracks you're going to see. But it's surprising, I think, to people. That's the beauty of tracking in snow, is that what you can see just right in your own back or front yard.
Are there kinds of snow that are better for tracks?
Well, yes and no. It depends what you want to see. You know, there are lots of books available that help you to find to identify the tracks. But very, very rarely do you have prints that are as perfect as you see them in the books. And that's the frustration, I think, for some people. You know, you rarely see every single toe. That light dusting we just had here in Ames this morning, we're getting a little bit of light snow now, is perfect for seeing the tracks of mice. And yes, you can identify even the individual toes sometimes in perfect snow or perfect mud. But rarely do you have those perfect conditions. So people, in order to identify what it is that's been there, need to understand both the patterns and sort of the context of what they're looking at.
Well, I think about this a lot when I'm out walking my dogs, because I have two black Labish mutts, but
right.
They have completely different gaits, and one of them moves more like a wild dog, where she picks her feet up. She doesn't drag them. All of her tracks are in a single file line, and her hind feet go exactly where her front feet were. And then the other one is a big...
A little wider, maybe?
It could be a herd of elephants that goes through where he goes through. You know, he makes so many tracks. But it's so fun to watch their patterns and then, you know, to think about those with wild animal tracks, too.
Well, and there's certainly differences between individuals, but because of difference in weight, different in size, you will see individual differences between critters. Sometimes you can tell if you watch an animal long enough and then watch them walk, you can tell if they have a limp. We had a deer last year we called Gimpy because her one leg, she'd been, I'm sure, hit by a vehicle on the road, and it healed, but it healed at a 90-degree angle. So most of the time she was walking on three legs and would use that fourth leg as a prop, if you were, and as balance. And so it would only come down in the snow every so often. So her gait was, of course, totally different than other deer. Certainly there are individual differences, but the patterns among animals are surprisingly similar. Let me give you an example. Earlier this week, I took a walk and on my land, and there's a lot of habitat, as you might imagine there, and I saw tracks of deer, of pheasant, of possum, squirrels and rabbits, of course, deer, mice, coyote, crows, and a number of songbirds, in addition to what appeared to be a raccoon, but I couldn't positively identify it because it had been snowed over. So, you know, just in a very short walk, and dogs and cats, of course, just in a very short walk, you can, once you learn how to read the landscape, and that's exactly what we're asking people to do when you're going tracking, is reading the landscape and reading what's happened there. You're not looking from individual track to individual track, but you look at the patterns, and you can tell you learn very quickly to read that landscape and say, oh, deer came through here last night, and there were probably a group of four, it looks like. A possum wandered through here. Oh, he wandered up underneath the bird feeder and gleaned some of the spilled feed from beneath the feeder, and then wandered off toward the creek. So you can tell stories about where they are in the landscape. The beauty is, I think you can not only tell stories, but you can learn more about the critter by following those tracks. You can learn where they live, how they live. You can see, oh, gee, there are broken branches here. Oh, no, they're not broken. If I look close, I can see the tooth marks on them. The rabbit or the squirrel has actually pruned the branches off at a very low area, and I can see that 45-degree cut to the angle of the stem. Gee, that's probably a rabbit. It's about a foot and a half off the ground. That means he probably stood on his hind haunches in order to clip that shrub. You know, all those stories, you learn more about the animal, and I think as a result, you not only learn about them, but you grow closer to them as a result.
So if you're just starting out, obviously, Jim, you have a whole lot of background and a whole lot of knowledge about the tracks and the behaviors of the animals that you're identifying. But if you're just starting out, how do you start identifying the tracks that you see? Because as you said, they're not always going to be clear. If the snow is deep, if it's fluffy, it's more of a drag, you know.
Right.
How do you identify those?
Okay, first of all is the pattern. And the pattern, different patterns you learn from looking at them. The best way is certainly to go with somebody who knows them and can explain the patterns to you. But let's just talk about the difference between squirrels and rabbits, for example. Squirrels and rabbits, as we know from watching them in the rest of the year, they're hoppers. And so you'll have the two front feet and the two back feet seem to go out at the same time. But there is a difference between the two. And they're about, particularly if you're dealing with big fox squirrels, they're close to the same size as cottontail rabbits, at least in deep snow. They'll look very similar. The difference, though, is their back feet and their front feet actually don't lead out at the same time. Animals that climb trees have what I call a 2-2 pattern, okay? And that is that their back feet are the larger, longer ones, and they are paired, equal in not only in length but in distance, and the front feet also are in pairs, so they're right beside one another. Now, it turns out when you're looking at a squirrel track and these two long and two short, the two short ones are a little closer together, and the two long ones are a little outside of those. And what you'll see, this 2-2 pattern then, two back and two front, if it's a climbing animal, a squirrel, a chipmunk, a deer mouse, those are always even in the snow. So you've got them beside one another, two back and two front. A rabbit, on the other hand, if you actually watch them hop, their front leg, one front leg comes out first, and then the other front leg comes out second, so a little in front of the other one. So that'll be a 2-1-1. So you have the two back feet that are beside one another. But the rabbit front of tracks are actually not beside one another, but one leads the other one. So it's a difference in the pattern. So all climbing animals, actually, all climbing rodents and rabbits, all climbing rodents, I'll put it that way, have this 2-2 pattern where the front and the back feet are equal.
Okay.
But the rabbits, which don't climb trees, obviously, their front feet don't go out at the same time, and so they're not quite equal to one another.
Okay, so that'll give you a hint. I suppose if the tracks lead right up to the base of a tree, that's another hint that you can pick up on.
Yeah, that's the context. That's the context. And so you look at the pattern, and then you look at the context. And the context is, okay, where am I? I'm in a woodland. There are big trees around, and the tracks go from one tree to another. And they're not on either side of the tree. They're just between trees. That tells me the animal is climbing, and therefore it's probably not a rabbit, unless it's a very, very clever rabbit. And it's probably a squirrel. So then you begin to look at the context of them as well. Let me give you another example. Deer are what I call lazy walkers. It doesn't matter if you've got a half an inch of snow or 2 feet of snow, they tend to drag their feet between the steps. So you'll see the deer track where the hoof went down, but then there's a drag, often a long drag, before it puts it down again. And that drag is very typical, and so you can tell deer tracks from quite a distance just by looking at that pattern.
We'll talk more about tracks, deer tracks, and all kinds of other tracks in just a moment. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we'd love for you to join our conversation with your questions or your tracking stories. Let us know what you've seen out in the snow. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today, wildlife biologist Jim Pease, who joins us once a month to talk about wilderness and wild creatures in Iowa. And Jim, so we just learned that deer are toe draggers.
The lazy walkers.
Right. Yeah, by the way, no judgment here. But
if you'd
like to join our conversation, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I suppose they're just conserving energy.
I don't know why it is, but it's just as very typical of deer tracks. I want to go back to the squirrels and rabbits too for a second, because there's a surprising thing. I think people, until you watch the animal actually hop, you don't realize this. But when you see a track, the two long back feet actually land in front of the front feet. So you can also tell the direction of the track, okay? So it's actually, they're leading, it looks like in the track, they're, because of the way they hop, they lead out, and then their back feet land in front of the front feet. So you think it's the other, they're going the other direction, but they're not.
So are they? Are the back feet turned outward?
Yes, slightly. They're turned slightly outward. In part depends on the depth of the snow, but they are turned slightly outward. So you see sort of almost like a V.
Okay, good. So they're going the direction I thought they were going. I mean, that's reassuring.
Right.
We have to do a lot of close our eyes and imagine on this program.
Right, yeah.
Jim.
This is a visual program on the radio. So
at least we didn't have to go out and find all the tracks to bring you pictures.
Well, I'd be glad to take you out.
So let's get back to deer, because deer can't always drag their feet. That must be a way to tell the difference between a walking deer and a running deer.
Correct, yeah. When they're running, although there are certainly drag marks in deep snow where they're bounding, as they come out of the snow, there's certainly a certain amount of drag. But when they're walking, they definitely drag each foot between the two.
Is it sometimes difficult to follow deer tracks if they are bounding? Because they can really go a long way between each jump.
It depends how fast they're bounding. But in the snow, you can usually see that pretty readily. And that's the danger, I think. People look at individual tracks, and you have to – that's why I say look at the pattern, not just an individual track. Because if you're looking for that next track, you may miss the context and the pattern in the snow. And so look at the overall pattern. Let me give you another example. Animals in the weasel family, for example – including weasels and mink and otters in this case, you know, that sort of loping gait where they're going up and down as they run through the snow. You can always tell their pattern because their back feet land in virtually the same place that their front feet were. And so you'll see this series of diagonal lines as they've landed in each sort of diagonal as you're looking down them. They won't be, you know, square. They'll be at a diagonal, and you'll see this series of diagonal lines as they lope from place to place. And you can tell immediately, weasel, smaller, mink, middle size, otter, much larger. The other thing that otters throw in is they'll because they're just fun-loving, that's all there is to it, they'll throw in a few slides on the snow. Even on flat ground, they'll take a roll in the snow. And so you'll see these series of diagonal, fairly large diagonal lines. It'll be 6 to 8 inches across, and then a roll, you know, through the snow. So it's easy to tell them.
What about tail drags? Do you see a lot of that in the wintertime?
Yeah, you do, especially with certain critters. Otters, opossum. That's how I knew it was an opossum track, in fact, when I was out earlier this week, because they constantly drag the tail. And it's first on one side, then on the other. And even though I couldn't see that almost star-like pattern of their individual feet, because they've got a sort of a thumb-type thing that sticks out to the side, I could tell from the pattern in the snow with that tail drag first on the left, then on the right, then on the left, then on the right. I could tell, yep, that's a possum. So you look at that pattern even if you can't see the individual footprints.
When you describe that, I'm also getting an idea of the speed at which the possum was probably moving.
It's not usually very fast. That's right. Right.
We have an email from Teresa in Redland, and she says, what shreds tree branches that are higher than head level and always horizontal? I often see this in the woods. It looks like something a cat would do, but I don't think that's possible where I live in northeastern Iowa.
Right. Yeah, it's probably squirrels. Squirrels often will shred bark to line their nest with. And they'll even do this sometimes on warm day in midwinter, and we had a series of those warm days, what was that, a week ago now? They'll improve that nest. They'll say, gee, my insulation is not good enough in this place. And so they'll go and they'll shred a little more bark. They'll especially do that towards spring, and that's for a different reason, though. It's not to line their nests with, but it is for getting at the sap that begins to flow in the trees in March. And so they're doing it for different reasons. But this time of year, if you see shredded bark, it's usually squirrels. Now, the other possibility, certainly, is that there are critters who will mark their territory shredding a tree, the side of a tree. Buck deer do this in the fall of the year by rubbing their antlers. Those antlers are living things, and during they grow during each year during the summer, and at the end of the year, the it's like dried skin; it itches, and so they want to get that off of there, and they'll use that then to rub. They'll rub them against a tree. And they have glands then that leave a little scent, a little perfume behind that says, "Hey, baby, come see me. I'm really hot, you know, and I'm the best buck in the woods." And so they're leaving advertising, if you will, behind. So it's sort of a dual purpose for them as well. Bears often mark their territory with scratches, and the same reason.
Would be uncommon in northeastern Iowa.
Right, right. So do cats. Everything from bobcats to mountain lions mark their territory. But if she's talking head height, is that what the
email says? Higher than head level.
Higher than head level.
And always horizontal.
Yeah, probably squirrels then. Always horizontal. They're out on a branch and they're shredding that bark to scrape it up. It would probably be horizontal on the branch.
All right. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Roy in Rolfe, Iowa, sent us an email about a different kind of track. He says, "I'm looking out the window in our large backyard in the city limits and see 9 big hollowed out areas in the 10 inches of smooth snow. I know what they are because this morning I saw a deer lying down flat on its side sleeping. Right. He jumped up when I turned on the room lights and went to eat at the feeder. Obviously, he had friends with him earlier in the night." But that's another track that you see in the wintertime, though.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the beauty of following the tracks. It's not just a matter of looking at a single track or a single footprint. That in itself is nice, but by following it, you can actually learn more about the critter. You can find those deer beds. You can find where is it that the weasel is holing up at night. Where is it that the deer mouse is hiding? It's underneath that log. Maybe it's a hollow. Sure enough, it's a hollow log. Or the skunk is holed up underneath my deck. all of
a
those
good
things.
Thing to know.
Yeah, you can learn sort of the context of their life. One of my favorite tracking books is a book called "Tracking and the Art of Seeing" by Paul Resendez, and Rezendes. And he says, ultimately, tracking an animal makes us sensitive to it. A bond is formed, an intimacy develops. We begin to realize that what is happening to the animal and to the planet is actually happening to us. We all are one. Tracking and reading sign help us to learn not only about the animals that walk in the forest, what they're doing, where they're going, but also about ourselves. And I think that was a really a neat statement about the beauty of following tracks, because you can find those hollowed out areas and know that the deer was laying down there. And then when they stand up, you see where they've kind of melted the snow, and you can tell how many were bedded down there together. And by the size, you can say, oh, this was a doe and twin fawns, or a doe and, boy, this one's really big. I wonder if a buck was here with them.
Well, it's neat that Roy got to see a deer sleeping flat on its side, because you don't see that often. You usually
not
think
very
about
often.
Deer sleeping
right.
Sort of upright.
Yeah. Well, they'll sleep curled up in a circle because in the wintertime, the more round you make yourself, you expose less surface area to the wind, and therefore you conserve energy. So dogs and cats will curl up. You'll see, everybody's seen huskies in the snow all curled up in almost like a ball. The guard hairs then tend to fluff up that feathers and create dead air space in that fur underneath the guard hairs. Deer have a little bit different because they have actual hollow hair. And the hollow hair has airspace in it, and then they use those the spaces between that. Again, it's all about insulation. It's all about dead airspace.
You mentioned a skunk a little while ago, and skunks aren't something that you see out a lot in the wintertime, although you start to see them in February and March. But they're so low to the ground. Their legs are so short and stubby. What do their tracks look like?
Well, it depends on the depth of the snow.
If it's over a half an inch, I wouldn't think.
In a half an inch of snow, snow, you'll see, especially as the winter wears on here, and you mentioned in February, those are usually males. You can actually look at the track and see, oh, that's a male skunk. That's because the males usually are out checking out where all the females are in his territory and making sure they're okay. And so he'll actually travel sort of from one den to another. He knows where they are, and you'll see their pattern in the snow, that sort of loping gait. They're actually four legs across because they kind of run sideways almost, and four footprints, and you'll see them in a diagonal line, but you'll see individual footprints. And sometimes as they slow down, you'll see that tail come down and you'll see the tail drag, but usually they lope with the tail kind of up enough so that it doesn't drag in the snow.
And their footprints are, they just have such chubby little stubby feet, too.
Yeah, they're not that far apart. No. That's right. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So.
We had another email from Mike in Nevada. He says, my first observation in Wisconsin I had as a child of an otter track along a bank. I thought at the time it was made by something that was drunk, but soon I learned from my granddad that it was sliding and rolling.
Right, right. And that's the other thing about context. Think about the context of where you are. We're right along a riverbank. What's likely to be here? And certainly deer, mink, even muskrats and beaver will be there. But otter slides are very, as Mike has described them, are very distinctive. They run and play and will slide down a bank. And even on level ground, you'll see these slides where they'll go use that very smooth guard hairs on their skin to slide through the snow. It's really quite distinctive, unlike anything else.
If you'd like to share some of the tracks you've seen in wintertime, give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear your stories, or if you have any questions that Jim can answer, give us a call, 866-780-9100. And thinking about Teresa's email about the shredded branches made me wonder about bobcats, because bobcats are making a comeback in Iowa. What kinds of tracks do we see from bobcats in the winter?
There are a couple of things about bobcats that are very distinctive. One is, again, the context, and they are not, of course, going to be in cities and towns. They'll be out in the wildest country in your area, and they have spread in across many counties, but they're still the real population of them seems to be primarily in the southern half of Iowa, especially in the more wooded areas along there. They're actually pretty well prepared for winter because, like their cousins, the lynx, the Canada lynx, they actually grow extra hair between their toes to keep them on top of the snow. The lynx is even more dramatic, but you'll even see it in bobcats, so extra stiff hairs that grow between their toes, kind of like a snowshoe. And I listened to your show on Monday, Charity, when you were talking about snowshoeing and how is it difficult? I think you were asking the question about is it hard to learn?
Right.
And,
I'm trying to find the joy in snowshoeing. Yeah, I've never found it myself. So.
Well, I tell you, if you spend much time in areas where there's a lot of deep snow, you will find the joy. I remember when I was in northern Alberta in Canada doing research, I tried one day. I thought the same thing. I thought, oh, my golly, I'll just go without my snowshoes. I can get through it. And the snow was about 3 feet deep. And I became exhausted very quickly. And I was amazed, even as young and as in great shape as I was, of course, it's an exhausting thing. And so staying on top of that snow, and I spent almost every day of the rest of the winter on snowshoes, doing tracking and other things, and they really do keep you up on top of the snow. The old-fashioned ones, I wore what are called main ski shoes, which have a very upturned tip and are about 4 feet long, really do keep you on top. The more modern ones that are aluminum, more like what I call bear paws, and are made really for racing, not so much for keeping you on top as much as the old-fashioned ones are. and they work, but they don't work as well, I find, as the gut strung ones with a wooden frame. So I think there are some differences, and the joy is, man, I can move in the winter. I can get out. It's in fact, I will usually snowshoe my trails first before I ski on them, because it kind of packs the snow down a little bit and makes skiing much more pleasant.
When you're out and you see tracks that look canine, how do you tell if you're looking at a coyote track or if you're looking at a dog track?
Okay. Now, if you can see individual tracks, it's very difficult to tell the difference between coyote and a large dog. It's possible, but it's not. Again, look at the context. Are there dogs likely around here? Have there been hunters through here with their dogs hunting for pheasant? It's late February. That's not going on anymore. Are there dogs likely in the area? No, not very likely. It's probably a coyote by the size of the track. And a coyote will often be 2 inches or more in diameter, 2 to 3 inches sometimes even in diameter. And you can usually, if you can see an individual track with dogs and other canids, fox and coyotes, you'll be able to see the nails, the toenails, because the nails are always there. Compare that to a bobcat, for example, or a house cat, where they have retractable nails. Those are more round than dog tracks are, and you tend not to see the individual nails.
Okay.
So it's quite a big difference between them. But telling the difference between a large dog and a coyote track is pretty difficult for most folks. But think about the context and the time when you're seeing it.
We're talking about animal tracks in the snow today with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we've been talking about all of the wonderful things you can see in the snow when you go out in the winter, the animal tracks that you can see, and what you can actually learn from those tracks. And Jim, we have a Jay on the line in Rock Island, and we're going to get to him in just a minute, but I want to ask one more question about wild dogs. We were talking about coyotes and fox. So are there specific kinds of gaits that we would see as well? I was talking earlier about watching my dogs and how one of them walks with her feet in a single line and her hind feet go into her front footsteps. Do you see that kind of thing in a wild dog?
Yeah, you certainly do, especially in fox. If fox are crossing an open area, trying to get to an area where they might find some mice and that, you'll see their tracks will go literally in a straight line, because as they walk, their front foot goes. They kind of it's a very sexy gait because they're walking in a very straight line with the front feet and the hind feet are right behind one another, and so you'll see this single line of tracks, and that's that the gait is a very fast one. They're walking, but they're walking in very much in a straight line, so that those tracks literally are in front of one another.
It looks very efficient.
Yes, very, very efficient, as a matter of fact. And coyotes will sometimes do the same thing, although coyotes tend to they'll tend to lope more when they're going across places, or you'll see the bounds in the snow where they're going from one place to another. And both of them are usually solitary hunters, and so they'll be interested in some of the same things, such as mice that they might smell underneath the snow. Sometimes, occasionally, if you follow that fox track, you can see as it's raised up on its back legs and dived into the snow and come up with a vole way underneath the snow, and you'll see this sort of sudden bound into the snow, and it's pretty remarkable to read this story.
Well, on the subject of predators, Jay has a question about predators.
Okay.
Hi, Jay.
Yes, hello.
Hi there. What's your question?
I was wondering. Are predators known to track their prey visually? I was just curious about that.
It depends on the time of the year. This time of year, it's primarily by scent. In terms of mammals, they're Mammals are, their sense of smell and senses of hearing are very, very keen. Birds, on the other hand, avian predators like hawks and owls tend to use visual. They have a very poor sense of smell or no sense of smell, and so they will use a visual way of tracking prey. Owls also use sound, but not scent. I have banded owls over the years, and I remember one time, to tell you how poor a sense of smell they have, I remember one time we captured a great horned owl, and it had obviously been with a skunk the night before. And boy, did it reek. And I didn't think we could band an owl quite as fast as we did. But we decided that we weren't going to be, we didn't want to be around that strong skunk smell. Didn't seem to bother him at all, but certainly bothered our mammalian senses much more than it would bother the owl.
But uh-huh. But they wouldn't actually use tracks that they'd see in the snow.
No. Although it's surprising, you kind of wonder sometimes. Occasionally you'll see a fox track, and it'll cross another track, say a white-footed deer mouse or a white-footed or a deer mouse track in the snow. And all of a sudden that straight fox track turns, and you wonder whether they've seen the track or they've smelled it. I suspect they've smelled it, but you know, boy, you got to wonder sometimes. So, no, they don't usually use tracks, but I do wonder that they might be able to see something that disturbed the snow anyway.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. That was very interesting.
Thanks a lot. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Of course, human predators do use tracks.
Correct.
Find creatures.
Yeah.
Back to the subject of predators, though. What kind of marks do you see in the snow if a hawk takes a mouse or something like that?
Well, that's a great one, because we haven't talked about bird tracks yet. And bird tracks, sometimes you can see the actual tracks where they have three toes forward and one toe back. And by the size, you can tell if it's a songbird, which is, you know, usually less than an inch or half an inch in size. If you look out on your patio and a light dusting of snow around your feeder, you'll see they tend to hop. You watch the juncos or the white-throated sparrows, and they'll hop through, and you'll see those actual individual tracks. Or you can tell that it's a pheasant because it's two and a half inches in size, or a turkey, which might be 4 to 5 inches in size from the front toe to the back. But you also look then at the pattern. If those front two toes are curved in, so you might call it, I think the common knowledge or the common nomenclature is pigeon-toed. They tend to sort of walk with a sway. It's actually not pigeons, but crows. Crows will tend to, if you watch their individual tracks in the snow, they sort of go from one side to the other in a waddle or a swagger, if you will, and their toes then curve in. The other thing, then, is you're watching some of these, you'll see sometimes, if you're following a white-footed a mouse and or a deer mouse, and you're seeing these little tracks, they've got a little tail drag between their two tracks, and all of a sudden you see a big depression in the snow. And look at the side of that depression, you'll see wing marks. You'll see as they take off, and you say, oh, an owl or a hawk came down and got that mouse. Or you'll see a pheasant, all of a sudden the tracks end. Look at the side of the track, and you'll see the primary feathers will scrape that snow as they take off. So you can tell the story that went on there. The pheasant was running because there's 2.5 feet between tracks. It was really moving. And all of a sudden, you see the wing marks in the snow, and you say, well, gee, I was coming pretty close to him, and oh, there he goes. And you can see where he took off. Or you can see that where the owl has plunged into the snow to grab the rabbit or grab the mouse, and you'll see the wing marks inside. Sometimes you'll see blood on the snow and maybe even a bit of fur or feathers left behind, and you can tell the story that went on there.
John's on the line from Dubuque with something to add to our raptor tracking story. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Hi, what would you like to add?
You were talking about tracking, and I know Jim is aware of this, I'm sure, but raptors are able to determine that there's movement underneath the snow.
Right.
They may not be following tracks per se,
right,
but they can, you know, voles make this little ruffle in the snow as they burrow through, and so raptors are able to spot that, probably coyotes too. Hey, there's one other thing that's kind of off the track, but we've learned recently that kestrels have a visual adaptation that we weren't aware of that could see into the ultraviolet, which means they're able to track a mammal, probably not during the winter, but they're able to track mammals by following their urine trails.
Fantastic.
So they can even see a trail of urine. So,
oh, how cool.
So there's a lot we don't know about this stuff.
You bet. They teach, and that's the beauty of tracking, John, as you well know, is that you learn something every day when you go out and you say, gee, I never didn't know they could do that. And that's exactly right. So getting out there and seeing it firsthand is absolutely key. Thanks for bringing that up, because you're right. They can see the movement under the snow. And you'll often see, if you're ever able to watch a fox or a coyote hunting mice, you watch them, and yes, they certainly use their nose, but they are watching. They'll stop.
Yeah.
And watch that snow, and watch that. They're able to either hear the movement in the grasses under the snow, the voles that actually tunnel underneath the snow and seldom come to the surface in the wintertime, or they're actually seeing the snow movement and they pounce on it then, just as many hawks are able to detect that movement under the snow. So thanks for bringing that to our attention. That's fascinating about being able to follow the ultraviolet of urine marks.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if we discover that anybody else can do that too. That's amazing.
Hey, thanks for your work, Jim.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Thank you very much for your call, John. You know, it's interesting when you watch wildlife videos of fox or coyotes hunting, and you see them make that kill leap into the snow.
Oh, it's amazing.
And so often they come up empty-handed, but it looks fun, even if they're not getting anywhere.
Well, I often take kids out tracking in the winter, and we try and duplicate the tracks that we see, duplicate the patterns and the leaps and that sort of thing. I'm not able to do that anymore, but sometimes kids can land with their back feet in front of their front feet and their hands, and they can imitate the squirrel tracks, and sometimes they can make that leap into the snow, and they think it's fun. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You bet.
Glenn is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hello, Glenn.
Hi, Jody.
Hi.
Enjoying your show.
Oh, thank you. What's your question?
I wonder if Jim Peace has ever seen a bear in Iowa.
No, not in Iowa.
No.
They certainly were here originally before Euro-Americans came and settled this. They were certainly here when Native Americans were here. And prior to settlement in the 1830s. And occasionally we get bears that wander down. Bears.
There was one spotted this year.
This year, right, right.
And, at least last year.
Right, yeah, in 2010. And they do certainly wander in from the north. Bears are very, very territorial, both females and males. And
is that right?
Yeah, and they will drive out, particularly males will drive out younger bears. And increase the size of their territory. There are lots of studies done on black bears and found that the older the population, the older the males in the population, the fewer the bears are in that population, because they tend to hold larger territories. And if you remove, if you remove that senior male bear, it opens up several territories for younger male bears. Then,
because, well, I see. Yeah. Something happened to me. I'm an over-the-road truck driver. I was in northern Maryland,
uh-huh.
And a black bear the size of a Mini Cooper attacked my truck. I swear he was going to bite my steer tire.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And it was huge, and it was fast.
Yeah. Yeah, very fat this time of year, you bet. And they're not generally out. They're not true hibernators in the sense that ground squirrels are. But like skunks, they'll spend a lot of the winter sleeping, and they will occasionally on January thaws and that, or December thaws as we had this year, get up and wander out to see if they can find something to eat.
And why would they attack a vehicle?
I have no idea.
Okay. See, it was quick. It came came out of the meeting, I had just seen a sign that said, watch out for Maryland wildlife. And I was like, yeah, right. And then I said, wow.
You'll take those signs more seriously.
It is surprising the states in which bears still exist, and Maryland is one of them. Connecticut, Massachusetts also have bears. Certainly up into the New England states, quite a few bears, and lots of bears in upstate New York. And as I say, occasionally, we certainly have them in Minnesota, and they will occasionally have usually a young male, wander south into Iowa, but they're not common here anymore.
All right, Glenn, thank you so much for your call. And Ray is on the line in Mason City, also asking about a creature from up north. Hi, Ray.
Excuse me. I've asked this about DHS for a number of times, or DNR.
Uh-huh.
When was the last time we saw wolves in Iowa? I remember box hunting them when I was a kid back in the 50s.
Okay. Well, you probably weren't hunting wolves in Iowa in the 50s. The last timber wolves that were native to Iowa were in the late 1800s, 1880s. If you look at a book called A Country So Full of Game by Jim Dinsmore, you will find stories in there of what happened to lots of Iowa's wildlife in the late from the 1830s up to the present, but especially in the late 1800s, because many species disappeared during that time period. The large predators, actually, we certainly had bears and even had a prairie grizzly at that time. We had wolves, and we had mountain lions very commonly across the state. And because they were competitors for the same resources that our ancestors wanted, they disappeared relatively quickly. And those resources that our ancestors wanted were things like deer, elk, and bison. And because they were competitors, the predators went very quickly.
Well, and there were a lot of there was a great deal of fear of them as well, that led that.
What you were probably hunting in the 50s here were coyotes, and occasionally you'd have what's called a coy dog or a coyote dog cross. They're a hybrid. They tend to get hybrid vigor. In some parts of the country, they call them, they're often called brush wolves, even though they're not wolves at all. But they're a hybrid between the coyote and the dog, and they look very wolf-like. They tend to, like dogs, the females come into season twice a year. And so you'll often see the pups in midwinter as well as during the summer months. And so that's very likely what you saw then.
Ray, thank you so much for your call. And Jim, we've just talked about bears and wolves, and so many other species are making a comeback in Iowa. Do you think that we're going to see these species in the future?
I think it all depends on whether or not we decide as a society that we're going to allow them to exist. In livestock areas, they tend to take livestock. We will certainly see bears from time to time. Whether we will continue to allow them to exist depends on our laws and what we as a society decide to do.
Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure. I just want people to get out there, look at tracks, look for other signs, learn the stories of the critters around you.
Well, you've certainly given us a lot of great things to look for today.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease, he's a wildlife consultant and educator in the Ames area. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support in Ames from Russell Mansky. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, you can send us your comments or questions anytime. Tell us what you'd like to hear on the show or tell us about something that you heard on the show. Send us email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about bringing first-class sporting events to the state of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be right back.